Welcome to SCOTUSCast, National Park Service Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 20, 2016, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in Sturgeon v. Frost. Sturgeon challenged a National Park Service ban on the operation of hovercraft on the National River, part of which falls within the Yukon-Charley River National Preserve. The state of Alaska then intervened, challenging NPS's authority to require its researchers to obtain a permit before engaging in studies of chum and sockeye salmon on the Algonac River, part of which falls within the boundaries of the Katmai National Park and Preserve. Sturgeon and Alaska contended that the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act precludes NPS from regulating activities on state-owned lands and navigable waters that fall within the boundaries of National Park System units in Alaska. The district court ruled in favor of the federal government, and the Ninth Circuit affirmed that judgment as to Sturgeon, but ordered that Alaska's case be dismissed for lack of standing. The question before the court is whether the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act prohibits the National Park Service from exercising regulatory control over state, native corporation, and private Alaska land physically located within the boundaries of the National Park System. To discuss the case, we have Gail Norton, who served as the 48th U.S. Secretary of the Interior. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Ms. Norton.
On its face, Sturgeon v. Frost seems like an unusual case to be accepted for certiorari by the U.S. Supreme Court. The facts are deceptively simple, but the implications for the state of Alaska are very significant. The setting for this case is the Nation River within the Yukon-Charley River's National Preserve. The Nation River is a navigable tributary of the Yukon, and its headwaters are in Canada. The preserve is on Alaska's border with Canada. It is an area of almost 4,000 square miles, larger than the state of Delaware, and slightly smaller than Connecticut. There are no roads within the preserve, so visitors arrive by airplane, or by river in the summer, or snowmobile or dog sled in the winter. The preserve is administered by the National Park Service. Hunting and fishing are specifically allowed. In 2007, a lone hunter, John Sturgeon, rode his hovercraft up the Nation River to do some moose hunting in the Alaska backcountry, as he had done on many occasions in the past. When Sturgeon stopped his hovercraft on a sandbank, three National Park Service rangers approached. They informed him that the Park Service rules prohibited the use of hovercraft on the river, which was within the boundaries of the Yukon-Charley River's National Preserve. Rangers told him he would be subject to prosecution if he brought his hovercraft into the National Preserve again. Eventually, Sturgeon decided to file suit to resolve the issue. Why is this case important? The importance to the state of Alaska is reflected in the fact the state attempted unsuccessfully to intervene as a party. The state did, however, participate actively as amicus curiae, and an attorney for the state was allowed to present oral argument in a division of time with Sturgeon. The state argues that this affects their sovereign ability to govern, as well as having practical impacts. The outcome of this case will affect millions of acres of state, private, and native-owned land within parks, wilderness areas, and wildlife refuges. By one count, there are 19 million acres of non-federal inholdings within the boundaries of Alaska conservation units. Alaska Native corporations are especially affected because many of the inholdings are owned by them. This can affect mining, oil and gas development, transportation, hunting, fishing, and other economic activity in Alaska. Despite this case's humble beginnings, the U.S. Supreme Court granted cert. Should we expect that their ruling will have implications for public lands in the lower 48? Public land management is often based on interpretation of statutes that have a narrow application. Congress created most national parks, for example, by adopting specific laws defining unique circumstances for that particular park. They may allow existing hunting or fishing practices or existing mineral extraction to continue. Congress may designate other lands as wilderness or require that certain historic structures be preserved. Thus, whenever federal land managers make decisions, it is important to consider the unique statutory provisions that apply. The Supreme Court's approach to this case could thus illuminate the powers of the National Park Service and other land management agencies. However, it is much more likely that the decision will be more narrow, decided on the basis of statutes uniquely applicable to Alaska. This case instead appears to have reached the Supreme Court based on its importance to the state of Alaska. The Supreme Court may be inclined to accept important cases from Alaska because there is otherwise no meaningful review of Ninth Circuit decisions interpreting major federal laws governing the state. The Supreme Court cannot wait for a split in the circuits when only the Ninth Circuit has jurisdiction. The Ninth Circuit decision, written by Judge Jacqueline Nguyen, ruled in favor of the federal government, finding that the Park Service could regulate navigable waters in Alaskan parks, just as they do waters in parks throughout the rest of the country. I will describe the Court of Appeals' rationale after I set out more of the background of this case. Sturgeon v. Frost provides a great opportunity to consider the unique history of Alaska, and it can only be understood against that background. Alaska became a state in 1959. In this largest of states, there were only 250,000 people, of whom about 1/5 were Alaska Natives. The vastness of the state and its frontier lifestyle created unique governance problems. Many issues of land ownership needed to be resolved in the first few decades after Alaska's statehood. Alaska residents wanted to create opportunities for economic development. Alaska Natives sought to obtain ownership of traditional lands. Environmentalists wanted to see Alaska's dramatic landscapes and wildlife habitat preserved for the long-term future. The U.S. Congress was the arena in which these battles took place, since most of Alaska's land was federally owned. Three major pieces of legislation were enacted to resolve competing visions for the state. First, the Alaska Statehood Act allowed Alaska to take advantage of the equal footing doctrine, meaning that Alaska would come into the Union with essentially the same advantages as existing states. Relevant to this case, the state obtained ownership of all submerged lands, which are those lands underlying navigable lakes and rivers. The Statehood Act also said the state would obtain 100 million acres of land. Given that the ownership of so much of the state was still unresolved, the state was given time to choose exactly which lands it wanted. The state began to make selections of land, but many of the lands it wanted were also subject to claims by Alaska Natives. One Alaska history source described the situation this way, quote, "By 1966, title to Alaska land was in complete confusion. Between 1959 and 1966, the state had indicated the lands it would like, and Natives continued to protest. By 1966, more land was under protest than the total number of acres in the state, because many Native claims overlapped. No planning for economic development could take place if potential investors did not have clear title to the lands they were interested in." Close quote. The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was adopted in 1971 to address the land claims of Native Alaskans. Rather than the Indian reservation approach used in the lower 48, the law recognized Native corporations. These corporations would be allowed to select particular lands for ownership. 44 million acres of traditionally used lands would go to them. Still unresolved was the question of lands that would be preserved as parks and other conservation areas. President Jimmy Carter used his power under the Antiquities Act of 1916 to designate large national monuments. This caused an uproar among those who wanted to see economic development, and ultimately the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act was passed to further delineate Alaska land ownership. ANILCA, as the act is referred to, designated a number of parks, wildlife refuges, wilderness areas, wild and scenic rivers, and so forth. It is interpretation of this law that forms the core of Sturgeon v. Frost. ANILCA essentially drew boundaries around large areas of land for parks, refuges, and so forth. Within those boundaries were tracts owned by Native corporations, private owners, or the state. But although these non-federal lands were within the boundaries, they were not to be considered part of the conservation unit. ANILCA distinguishes those lands from public lands, which are defined as lands, waters, and interests therein, the title to which is held by the federal government. This definition of public lands, in Section 102 of ANILCA, is at the heart of Sturgeon v. Frost issues. Only public lands are considered to be truly parts of the conservation units to be administered by the federal agencies. Section 103 of Alaska further specifies that these state, private, and native lands are not subject to the regulations that apply to public lands within the units. The Ninth Circuit opinion in this case focuses on Section 103. The appellate court briefly set out the provision and its statutory history, saying, quote, Section 103C declares that state, native, and private-owned land shall not be subject to regulations applicable solely to public lands within such units. Accordingly, under Section 103's plain text, only public land lying within a conservation unit's boundaries may be subject to unit-specific regulations. Non-federal land is expressly made exempt from such regulations. As the 1979 Senate report on ANILCA makes clear, non-federal land would not be subject to management regulations, which may be adopted to manage and administer any national conservation unit which is adjacent to or surrounds the private or non-federal public lands. Close quote. At this point in reading the Ninth Circuit decision, one might think that the judges would side with Alaska and Mr. Sturgeon. But then the court departed sharply from their analysis. The Ninth Circuit further cited the legislative history and noted a key statement from the Senate report on ANILCA, quote, Importantly, for purposes of this case, in contrast to unit-specific regulations, federal laws and regulations of general applicability to both private and public lands are unaffected and would be applicable to private or non-federal public land holdings within conservation units, close quote. From this, the Ninth Circuit noted that the Park Service ban on hovercraft was a regulation that applied to Park Service areas across the country. The court, in essence, distinguished two types of Park Service regulations, those written for a specific conservation unit and those that applied on a nationwide basis. Private, state, and native lands within a unit would be exempt from those regulations specifically for that particular conservation unit, but those non-federal lands would be subject to any Park Service regulations that applied nationally. Since the hovercraft ban was a national regulation, it would apply on non-federal lands and waters within Alaska parks. This ruling, in my mind, leads to exactly the opposite result as contemplated by Congress in ANILCA. It appears to me that Congress clearly wanted to avoid burdening Alaska natives, the state, and private parties with federal land management regulations. In the grand bargaining leading to the passage of ANILCA, Congress agreed to the urgings of Alaska members of Congress that their citizens be governed by regulations written by those who understood the Alaska frontier way of life. That regulation would come from Juneau instead of Washington, D.C. Congress recognized that certain laws and regulations of national applicability should continue to apply on Alaska lands, but not the federal land management regulations. Under the Ninth Circuit approach, however, exactly the opposite result is achieved. Regulations arising from the land use plans for the Yukon-Charley Rivers National Preserve would not apply to, for example, a Native corporation's lands within the park. But regulations promulgated by the Park Service in Washington, intended to address visitor needs at Yellowstone or the Gettysburg Battlefield or the National Mall, would apply with full force to the Alaska Native land. Furthermore, the Ninth Circuit opinion makes it difficult for the National Park Service to correct Alaska inequities. Let's say that a future Park Service National Director decides that hovercraft operating on navigable rivers in Yukon-Charley are not a problem. The only way to make a change for Alaska would be to allow hovercraft throughout the United States. At the Supreme Court level, the Solicitor General's office seemed to recognize this difficulty and devoted only a small portion of its brief to defending the lower court decision. Instead, the government's argument focused on several alternative rationales. This was noticeable to the justices, who asked the Solicitor's office in oral argument whether they were disavowing the Ninth Circuit decision. Although the solicitor expressed support for the lower court, it nevertheless seems that other arguments were viewed as being stronger. One issue in this case is the regulation of navigable waters. The river in question, the Nation River, is navigable and has been specifically held so in court. Pursuant to the Submerged Lands Act, states own the lands underlying navigable rivers. They are entitled to manage, lease, and develop the natural resources within those submerged lands. For example, if an oil deposit underlies a navigable lake or river, the state could lease the mineral right for development. Alaska and Mr. Sturgeon recognized the constitutional power of Congress to regulate navigation on navigable rivers. They argue, however, that Congress refused to delegate that power to the National Park Service within parks in Alaska. Thus, Congress could undeniably pass a law outlawing hovercraft on navigable rivers in parks in Alaska, but Sturgeon and Alaska argue that Congress has not done so. To further complicate matters, the federal government argues that the Park Service has another claim on control of the waters within Alaskan parks, the Federal Reserve Water Rights Doctrine. And I will discuss this more in a few minutes. A very sad development for the nation has serious implications for this litigation. The passing of Justice Scalia may influence the outcome of this case. As we all know, it is dangerous to predict the outcome of a case from oral argument. But Justice Scalia's remarks seem fairly skeptical of the federal government's position. Of course, Justice Scalia's well-known pursuit of hunting and fishing gave him an understanding of Mr. Sturgeon's plight in a way not generally understood by his colleagues on the court. Knowing that Justice Scalia would put statutory interpretation above his personal views, he seemed to disagree with several specific Justice Department interpretations. One argument presented on behalf of the Park Service was that the waters in question actually qualified as federal property under ANILCA's definition of public lands. The Park Service claimed Federal Reserve water rights in Alaska parks in the 1990s. The concept of Federal Reserve water rights began as a judicially created mechanism to ensure that Indian reservations obtained enough water to irrigate crops and otherwise achieve the standard of living envisioned by creation of the reservation. The courts inferred that Congress meant to reserve rights to use water as part of setting aside the reservation for Indians. Later, this concept was extended to parks with the idea that Congress meant to reserve use of water at the same time it reserved land for parks. To determine the water right, courts looked to the purposes for which a park was created and how much water would be necessary to fulfill those purposes. In Sturgeon versus Frost, the federal government said that they thus owned an interest in the water, and this created an ownership right sufficient to give them control over the waters as part of the public lands. Justice Scalia noted that a Federal Reserve right was simply a usufructory right, a right to use the water. He noted that the federal agencies unambiguously cannot regulate non-federal holdings. The federal government would need to show title to the water to be able to regulate. He said, "I don't think you can show title. Nobody holds title to the water." At another place, discussing whether the specific statute regarding Alaska governs over general Park Service provisions, Scalia noted, "It seems to me the Park Service doesn't have jurisdiction." In my mind, the intent of Alaska was clear, that Alaskans would be able to use float planes, snowmobiles, and other unique modes of transport, including hovercraft, to access their remote lands. The land management regulations applicable to conservation units like national parks don't always suit Alaska's needs. While Congress expected that general regulations like air and water pollution controls or Coast Guard regulations would apply in Alaska park boundaries, the inholdings would not be subject to federal land management regulations. Those of us in the lower 48 sometimes have a difficult time understanding the vastness of Alaska and the uniqueness of its situation. Sturgeon versus Frost clearly presents these unique situations, and it's up to the Supreme Court to determine how that uniqueness will be handled.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.